This is to the best of our knowledge. This hour, artificial creativity. Artificial intelligence has come a long way since the early days of computing. Today, intelligent machines can translate entire books, recognize images, manage weekly schedules, even host public radio shows.
Hey, not so fast. Siri, you can have the day off. Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. And how long before Siri and her artificial colleagues come back? Not just to read scripts, but to write them. Because now that machines can think, the next frontier in computer science is to teach them how to create. Make art, write stories, compose music. And in fact, it's already happening. This music, this is our theme song remixed by a computer. So how is this even possible? Well, let's back up. At Google, computer scientists have a program that they've taught to play a little musical game. Here's how it works. A human gives a musical prompt, 9 notes. That's all. Just a few notes. And the computer responds. And then keeps going. A little hesitantly at first, but as it gains confidence, you can hear it combining and shuffling those notes, not randomly, but deliberately. This is the sound of a computer improvising, making music. How did it learn to do that?
So this model is, in a very simple way, trying to understand music by listening to it and by predicting it. And once that model's trained, and it takes hours or days to train a model like this on thousands and thousands of musical scores, we stop and we say, okay, we're done training. Now we're going to understand what this model thinks about an existing piece of music. And so we give it a few notes, and the model then takes it from there. In doing so, writes a piece of music.
This is Doug Eck. He directs Google's new Magenta project, which is an experiment in teaching machines to make art. This particular program is an example of a recurrent neural network which has learned how to compose music. And for creative types who might be feeling just a bit threatened, Doug says just think of this as the next generation of electric guitar or camera.
With every technology, there seems to be someone who comes along and tries to use it to make art. The film camera is my favorite example. The film camera was, for 20 or 30 years, not considered an artistic instrument. It wasn't considered something that you would use to make art. It was considered something that would capture reliable image of the world. And lo and behold, artists come along and take that technology and break it slightly, overexpose the film, etc. And in doing so, they create something new that we haven't seen before. But really what it comes down to is one more step in the technology chain towards building ways for us to communicate with each other and to share our ideas.
What I love about that piece is that initial tentativeness. You can almost hear the computer thinking, but maybe I'm just anthropomorphizing.
Well, I think it's good that you're anthropomorphizing. We do it all the time. You know, the fact is, maybe this melody is interesting, maybe it's not. But when we respond to it in certain ways, like saying, oh, I love the beginning bit, or for me, I think the end bit gets a little bit repetitive. Yeah, we're pleased or not pleased in various ways.
That's the one that to me sounds a bit like a film score, which made me think that might be one potential really obvious commercial use for software like this.
Absolutely, absolutely. In terms of commercial applications of this kind of technology, music is this sort of background soundtrack to so many things in our lives. I'm not very interested in using Magenta machine learning models to write full symphonies and sit in a chair and listen to them. However, the idea that I might generate some music for a jog, and that because we're using machine learning, we can personalize, we can contextualize on things like tempo and energy and try to generate things that are really tailored for a particular listener. Like, at some level, what I want when I jog is not to be musically engaged. It's to be engaged in my jog and to have the soundtrack for that be built from the ground up so that I'm even more engaged. I guess it's, you know, pump stuff in my ears that's going to make me run a little faster and get my heart rate up a little faster, and I'd be really happy with that.
Could you play that out a little bit more? Because I can imagine that this is where computers are going, right? Everything is going to be personalized for us. So now we're going to have the soundtrack for our lives created by a computer that knows already what I listen to on my Spotify playlist.
Yeah, exactly. Except I wouldn't get too far ahead of yourselves. I wouldn't talk about, for example, using the same algorithm to give you the soundtrack for your wedding or your senior prom. I mean, there are times when I need some audio to do a job. Jogging is the best example that I can come up with. Another one is relaxation. Imagine we have a way to say, hey, you know, you're stressed out, and you throw your headphones on and you get some audio that we've used machine learning to better understand how to calm ourselves down and to do a better job of kind of getting us into some mental state that we want to be in. I think we can be there as well. And then, for example, let's say that I need a soundtrack for a video that I made. And I don't know how to make a soundtrack. I don't know how to do music. But maybe there are ways in which we can allow non-musicians to still add what you would think of as sort of the creative spice to the mix. So maybe we can ask them the right questions. Maybe we can give them the right user interface so that they can express themselves and we can help complete their thoughts musically for them and give them that soundtrack for, you know, their picture album of their kids or the graduation slideshow or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. Or that makes me think of another experiment you guys posted online recently. So Magenta wrote an original song. I think it starts with the first four notes of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Indeed it did.
Yeah, and you know, I don't want to insult your computer program, but it does not, when you listen to it, sound especially sophisticated. But then you end up inviting a couple of human musicians to play along with it. And that got into the, you know, realm of what I would call music.
I'm offended. I want you to know that.
Sorry.
For the insults. No, and I think you're right that even better, we didn't invite them. That's what I thought was so cool about this. We simply put that track out on our blog, and these musicians picked it up on their own.
Oh, you're kidding.
Decided to play on top of it. No, it's great.
Yeah, well, that maybe is an example of, you know, where you could imagine this going, where it's kind of like a human-computer partnership. It's not about the computer taking over and replacing human musicians. It's I don't know, another kind of entity to jam with or, you know, to use to make music in just in a different way.
It strikes me that, musically speaking, we do this all the time. So if you take an electric guitar plugged into a really gorgeous tube amplifier, maybe with a couple of pedals, forget about computers, there's nothing digital in this pipeline at all, and you just get it set so, and you strum a chord, and that chord just resonates and continues, and you move your guitar a little bit closer to the amp, and you keep that feedback going. Like, you feel like you're the one creating that noise, mm-hmm. and you are the one creating that noise, but let's face it, you're awfully reliant on technology for that, for these tubes feeding back in just the right way, for the guitar and the pickups doing what they want. But I don't think, you know, musicians who use electric guitars shouldn't be encumbered by the thought, oh, did the electric guitar make the music or did I? They should use the electric guitar and they should make music. And I feel exactly the same way about any models that we build with Magenta.
What's the blue sky you imagine?
Two blue skies. One blue sky is music that I didn't know could possibly ever exist and that is beautiful. Blue sky number two is that we really understand a little bit more about how music works, and specifically the almost magical behavior that people have, that they're able to do things like write melodies, all of the repetition and hierarchical structure that you see in music and that we really don't understand, that we'll understand some of that a little bit better and thus understand a little bit more about ourselves.
Doug Eck leads Google's Magenta program, which explores machine learning to create art and music. So an algorithm might not be able to spit out a chart-topping song, at least not yet, but it might be able to help you write a bestseller. Jody Archer used to work as an acquisitions editor for Penguin Books. She saw a lot of novelists struggling to write books that would sell. Then she went to grad school at Stanford, where she and her advisor created an algorithm to help. They fed it 3 decades worth of data, about 20,000 novels, and now the bestsellerometer can predict with 80% accuracy whether or not a new novel will be successful. Raymond Tungekar wanted to know more.
So how does this algorithm work? I mean, what kinds of things does the bestsellerometer look at?
We actually measure 28,000 points of data, and we use about 2,800 as relevant to whether a text will bestsell or not. So there's a lot of things there, obviously, but they come into five broadish categories: plot, style, theme or topic, setting, and character. So we're looking at those things, but in many different ways.
You know, let's talk about some of your findings. Let's start with theme. Are there certain themes or subjects that bestsellers tend to focus on?
Yeah, we found that genre was kind of a red herring. The topics that show up time and time again that bestsell are human closeness. And this is a topic that some reviewers of the book have said, well, isn't it obvious all literature is about human closeness? And actually, it's not really. This is a topic that's about, say, those scenes that are downtime between two major characters where they're kind of having a beer together or giving each other a hug or just saying, you know, what's up, buddy? And that's written into the text. Now, best-selling writers instinctively know that that has an effect on pace, character, how plot can go, and more amateur writers tend to miss out those key important themes. And so human closeness came out as number one if you want to be a best-selling writer, and we liked that. I mean, it says something about the nature of fiction and why we read, but it also showed us how often those writers that are not selling well are failing to include that soft human touch in their writing.
Let's move on to something that countless authors have wrestled with. What insights does your model offer when it comes to the plot or plot structure?
We found seven different plot lines, and we really found that all of the books fit into one of those plot lines. There isn't one above any other that we'd necessarily recommend you pick, but getting the curves right of that plot are important. You know, if you're going to write a man-in-hole book, as it's sometimes called, make sure that there's a deep hole and make sure he comes out on the other side. Or if you're going to write the romance story, make sure there is the high and the low. And the authors that we've helped improve their manuscripts, they found that they were tending to miss some of those curves. And as they improved, they were getting much more attention from agents and editors.
Did the model also look at pacing or at what point authors should start considering a plot twist of some sort?
Yes, the answer is quite quickly. Some, you know, authors famously say, you know, you've got 40 pages to hook a reader. Some people think it's generous, and you've got 10. I've spoken to some acquisitions editors and saying even that's generous. You've got about 3 pages. And a hook is really an emotional change in direction. If you go back and think about some of the novels that you've read, that moment you feel a hook happening is often an emotional twist, and that has to happen fairly quickly and fairly dramatically for a reader to start caring about characters, for them to get involved, for them to want to follow the plot and the character through the story. We like to see a downward or an upward movement from the status quo definitely within the first 10% of a book.
And as you mentioned earlier, the bestsellerometer also looked at style. What insights did the model offer?
We were finding at first that there seemed to be the separation between male and female authors, and we wondered if we were looking at some kind of male and female style. A lot of bestsellers seem to be coming in at what the computer detected as a more female style, and prize winners coming out more male. And then we went back to the drawing board and thought, is this really right? And our hypothesis has come to be that those books that have a traditional training, traditional literary background, writers that have gone through English degrees, there seems to be a prevalence with them winning prizes more than other writers. But writers that hit the list, we actually, especially with a first-time book, a debut, were hitting the list and had a background or training in journalism. So they were coming out of sometimes radio, sometimes print journalism, sometimes, you know, broadcast, advertising even. But they were coming from worlds where they'd learnt the everyday language of common man, this sort of speaking everyday language that everyone can understand without a lot of poetry or the poetic style that might go into more literary writing. So that journalism background really showed itself and makes sense, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, based on everything we've been talking about so far, you know, all the elements of best-selling novels, is there a book that kind of stands out as coming closest, perhaps, to being a perfect bestseller?
the only one book that the bestsellerometer gave 100% to was Dave Eggers' book called The Circle. And it was a nice surprise to us. And I think it was a great book.
Yeah, well, it seems like an ironic choice given that, isn't it about like an evil tech company?
It is, yeah. I mean, we definitely laughed in the office. We said, you know, the algorithm has chosen itself. It's about a young woman called May who lives in a sort of a Silicon Valley kind of world and works for a futuristic company that's maybe a baby of Googles and Facebooks and those kind of things, big into social media. And her job is to raise the scores of her feedback from customers. And of course, we laughed when the computer turns around and gave Dave Eggers 100% for his performance because the book is very dystopian in nature and a little bit fearful of advances in technology. So, yes, we make something of the irony there, that's for sure.
Well, you said that, you know, the bestsellerometer had an 80% rate of accuracy. I'm interested in, like, that 20%. I mean, were there some notable misses? Were there, for instance, examples of bestsellers that the model didn't think would be successful?
Yes, I think one of the biggest ones was George R. R. Martin with the Game of Thrones.
Oh, interesting.
There were some things that the model really liked about the books, but what is the case, I think, with his writing, I mean, definitely he's been helped by the great show that's about the books, but he writes in a way that doesn't conform to the patterns that we found to the standards of the list. That does not mean he's not a good writer. He's a great writer, many people's favorite writer, but it's not many writers that get away with introducing new to characters, making you fall in love with them, and then killing them. Another great one was Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which just was made into a movie, I think, as well. You know, a mashup of two big beloved themes, Austin and zombies, is always going to amuse people and attract attention. But again, I think that might explain the success rather than that book hitting a kind of understanding of the workings of plot and fiction that some of the other best-selling writers out there have achieved.
Jody Archer is the co-author of The Bestseller Code, Anatomy of the Blockbuster Novel. Raymond Tongakar talked with her. Coming up, what happens when a computer tries to create a musical? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about artificial creativity in this hour. And here's my question. When a computer program fixes a writer's novel or improvises a few bars of music, is that real creativity? I mean, even the smartest learning program is still just doing what humans programmed it to. Blaise Aguera y Arcas is a tech visionary at the forefront of artificial intelligence. He currently leads Google's Machine Intelligence Group in Seattle, where he brings together artists and engineers. He tells Steve Paulson that the newest deep learning models really can go beyond what they've been taught.
Yes, I think they can. What's really interesting about the modern systems is that they start off as these disorganized neural networks, so a bunch of model neurons wired up in a random way, and then they learn from example. And as you teach examples, they do develop concepts. They do develop understanding of some sort. And I think that that one can use that term in a legitimate sense. And, you know, I'm not by any means saying that they're conscious or that they you know, have ideas or that they are creative. But I am definitely saying that surprise is possible with a system like that.
You're talking about, I mean, if we come back to the world of art, then you're talking about the capacity to create a new kind of art that humans could never dream up, because, I don't know, there's a different kind of logic when it comes to machine learning.
That's true. When we see some of the things that get generated or hallucinated by deep neural nets, you know, it's a really trippy and weird kind of art, and it's not something that I've seen any person paint. Yeah, it is new and different, sure. And it is its own in some sense.
That's totally fascinating. I mean, you're saying we might have a totally new kind of art because of machine intelligence?
Yes, I'm sure that that's the case.
And this is and now you've been talking about sort of collaborations between computers and humans. But what if we get rid of the humans here? I mean, after you know, the original programming is done, I mean, it's just this other generation of machine learning. You're talking about that.
Sure.
I mean, that in itself could create something amazing.
Sure. Yes. I think that's all entirely possible. I mean, I'm not worried about artists not having jobs anymore over the next few years. But I do think it's absolutely possible for things to be generated more autonomously or less autonomously. You know, and again, one can relate this to the way, you know, what it felt like to be a painter toward the end of the 19th century. I mean, painter is what it meant typically to be an artist. You know, and there were all these debates about, you know, if you're a photographer, are you a real artist? You know, is the camera doing all the work for you? And, you know, and I think there's similar kind of parallel conversations we could have here.
Hmm. So has this stretched your own appreciation of art? I mean, have you seen, or I mean, I know that the technology is still in its infant stages, but have you seen some I don't know, new kinds of art that you just sort of would never have dreamed of before that you really like?
Yes, I think it has. I mean, on the one hand, it's made me look back at Cubism and at some of the things that Francis Bacon does with sort of, you know, heads in multiple poses and so on, because we see a bunch of that sort of thing happening with hallucination from networks that are designed to recognize faces, for example. So, you know, it's part of it is about sort of thinking about art as an experimental lab for human perception. So it certainly made me rethink a lot of that kind of stuff.
Now, you mentioned Cubism, and if we go back to Picasso's breakthrough, it seems that, I mean, what he was doing was not only drawing on the history of art, but he was, you know, he suddenly was incorporating African masks.
Yes,
and it sort
yes.
of, it seemed like it came out of nowhere. I mean, he was obviously drawing on sort of cultural currents in the air. And I guess I'm wondering if computers can do that. I mean, to me, that's like real creativity there. It's like bringing together stuff that no one had put together before.
Well, I guess, and maybe this is a little controversial, but I'm not always crazy about the kind of great man theory of creativity. you know, I think we often impute genius, we impute agency where it doesn't always belong.
So even someone like Picasso, maybe he wasn't as original as he's cracked up to be?
Well, I'm not trying to diss Picasso. I mean, I think he's spectacular. I love Picasso. But I also think that could computer art or, you know, art generated by machines do similar things? Sure. I mean, we're mixing in alien stuff in the same sense that African masks were alien to Europe in a lot of those kinds of ways, just by virtue of aiming some of these algorithms at training data that might be non-traditional. We're already doing that.
So where do you see all this going? What's the future of artificial creativity?
I'd be very surprised if in 20 years we don't have art that everybody acknowledges, you know, that you know, by that point it'll be normalized enough that even the critics, you know, will think about this kind of stuff as mainstream, and there will be great art that uses these kinds of techniques just as a matter of course.
Will we have a new kind of Turing test, you know, was it created by a computer or not?
I think that more fundamentally, the question is flawed, because whenever art is created, it's always created by some kind of hybrid between what we think of as people and what we think of as technology. When I use paintbrushes, when I use a camera, when I use Photoshop, you know, this is technology, and it's not separate from us. You know, we are a technological species. Your body and my body are both covered in clothes. You know, if you strip all of that away and we are naked, you know, in the wilderness, we are less than the humans that we are right now in a lot of ways.
Right.
So
I mean, to some degree, the advances of human civilization, which includes human creativity, is because of the way we've been able to use technology.
entirely technologically mediated, right? Maybe, you know, dancing naked might be the only form of creative output that isn't technologically mediated in some way.
Will there always be some kinds of human creativity that computers will never be able to do?
No. I think that any time one says yes to a question like that, it almost feels like waving a red flag in front of the bull of future history.
You know? Especially for someone like you, you don't want to say no. That's impossible.
Right. You really risk making a, you know, why would anybody need more than 64 kilobytes statement.
So even the great novel, I don't know, War and Peace, you know, the great epic novel that seems to express something timeless about human nature.
Yes.
You're saying computers in the future will be able to write those?
I think it's like asking, will you ever be able to take a picture that looks like a Caravaggio? The answer is yes. You know, if you set up a studio very carefully, or you, for that matter, you use Photoshop or something to, you know, synthesize brush strokes that look realistic, right? Then you can set up, you know, a photographic situation in a studio that takes a picture that looks like a Caravaggio. Doesn't diminish Caravaggio, and it doesn't diminish modern painting. But I'm not sure the question is even interesting, if that makes sense.
Sorry, I guess I'm trying to hold on to some shred of human originality here, and you're kind of blowing that idea out of the water.
Well, I'm not that into human exceptionalism, I suppose. You know, I'm not sure that I buy it, and I think that our investing a lot of our identity in this idea of being exceptional relative to our machines is that seems like shifting sands, and it seems. Like it's in a way denying what is most interesting about our humanity, which is our ability to shape our environment and to grow in ways that, you know, exceed the capabilities of our own body, you know, collectively, individually. Why are we so invested in that?
Well, this is totally fascinating and kind of mind-blowing, I have to say. Thank you.
Great. My pleasure.
Blaise Aguera y Arcas leads Google's Machine Intelligence Group in Seattle. Steve Paulson talked with him. So now that we know computers can write original music, how about an original musical? Could a computer come up with the next West Side Story or Hamilton? Well, that's what composers Benjamin Till and Nathan Taylor tried to figure out in a musical called Beyond the Fence. Their goal was to create what you could call the first computer-generated musical. So they teamed up with computer scientists around the world. Algorithms contributed melodies, lyrics, and storylines. Now, writing a musical is daunting enough, but try working with computer-generated melodies like this.
I took great delight in the moments where computers failed, I suppose, you know, because it is horrifying, the thought, you know, if computers were brilliant, if computers were turning out melodies that were better than my own or even half as good as my own, what does that actually mean for me?
Benjamin, you and Nathan relied on an algorithm to generate melodies for the musical. The algorithm was named Android Lloyd Webber. Pretty clever. Were you surprised by what you heard?
Well, I was sent off to Durham on my own. And as I walked in, this chap was playing really ferociously complicated piano music. And he told me, well, this is computer music. And he played me this first thing that came out of Android Lloyd Webber. And my first words were, well, how do we make that sound good? And he was so offended. And I said, because it's very much like the sort of thing a five-year-old would do. And he was really offended. And what?
Well, actually, when you think about it, it's extraordinary to think that a computer could come up with something that a five-year-old human could do. That is amazing. But we had the clock ticking and we had a musical to write.
So as I understand it, you began, or the computers began, by basically trying to reverse engineer a hit.
Yeah, there was a team of people working at Cambridge University in the mathematics department, and they analysed the scripts and the scores for nearly 1,700 musicals. It's the largest study of musical theatre that's ever been done.
Yeah, and specifics, you know, there must be a death in Act Two.
Of a major character, but not one of the main protagonists.
There must be the statistics pointed slightly towards us needing a female protagonist. Comedy number before the end of Act One, high energy opening number, high energy Act One closer, high energy Act Two opener.
One of the things that we found out was that we were being steered towards setting our show in the 1980s, so we had to go with that.
And bad news for you guys was that we were told we couldn't set it in America.
But I know that when we finally get the chance, there will be so much to say.
I want to move through a few of the different kinds of programs you worked with. To begin with, you need a plot, right? And so for that,
yes,
you turn to this machine, the What If machine. What does it do?
Well, that's a premise. And actually, I think all good musicals can be distilled into a premise.
So it's not giving you the actual plot. It's just giving you the spark of an idea for a plot.
So, for example, you know, what if there was a little orphan girl who just wanted to find love? You know, what if there was a French man who stole a loaf of bread and wanted to clear his name?
And we were given 600 different what-ifs to wade through.
God.
Some of them didn't make any sense at all. Some of them were nonsensical, completely and utterly rubbish. Some of them were foul and vulgar and full of expletives. I mean, it really covered the whole gamut. And then we found, out of these 600, then we found the one that we decided to use, and we knew we'd found the right one, and it'll be forever emblazoned on my memory. I don't think I'll ever forget it. What if there was a wounded soldier who had to learn how to understand a child in order to find true love?
Oh! And so that
from
becomes...
That,
so that, from that, you get your setting, right? The Greenham Common?
Not quite. We, okay. But it, we,
so the process we used was Google. Google came into
a valid
it.
Computer algorithm.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we Googled for 1980s conflicts and created an extensive list of conflicts that didn't happen in America but that happened in Europe. So we had things like the Cold War, the
Northern
Berlin
Ireland
Wall, the fall of communism, the Falklands War. And put them all into Google with various different words from the What If machine.
Soldier, child, wounded, understand.
And actually nothing was coming up until I typed in Greenham Common and found
those,
a drawing.
People who might not know, the Greenham Common was an RAF base in Berkshire, in not far from London, which housed US cruise missiles, nuclear cruise missiles, in the Cold War with Russia.
And was the site of a long-running women's peace camp.
Absolutely. There were a group of women who lived there for the best part of 10 years. More than that, 20 years.
Yeah.
Guarding the missiles, making sure that the message was sent out to the world that we didn't want cruise missiles on our soil, but also that they weren't safe where they were. Mm. And, you know, it's really interesting for me because... my mother was a CND woman, so she was one of those women that would go to places like Greenham and Molesworth and protest against the missiles. And I grew up for a time on a commune of CND women, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament women. So it's really interesting for me that came up. It felt like suddenly this whole computer thing had turned into something deeply human.
How did you come up with lyrics for this musical?
Well, I mean, as with all of these things, I mean, we haven't had much of a chance to talk about this side of things. The inspirational side of the computer programs was very, very useful. When it came to actually generating content, that's where we kind of came a little bit unstuck.
Clarissa was our lyricist.
This was a system that the Cambridge boys had put together to write musical theatre song lyrics. Mm-hmm.
And she had scraped how many songs from the internet?
About 7,000 musical theatre song lyrics from the internet. So the system itself had gone off on trawling Google to find musical theatre song lyrics and had learnt everything it knows about language from that. And by the end of the process, you could see there were sentences forming, but they were a little bit off-kilter, and that's what we had to work with.
Like what?
And,
what's an example of an off-kilter lyric?
Oh, gosh, a sentence would start off in sounding perfectly fine, but then end in a completely different tense from the way it began. So basically what we had to do with in terms of finding lyrics was we found little short statements and maybe four words put together or a half sentence that we could think, oh, that's really nice. And some of them were delightful and charming. And again, it was that thing of using those as the seeds of inspiration for our own human creativity was so much more effective than expecting the computers to do it all on their own.
I have to say, this sounds so much more difficult and so much more complicated than just writing a damn musical on your own.
You are right. It was a difficult task. There's no getting around that. It was possibly one of the most difficult collaborations we've had to face, and we've done a few.
I mean, it really did nearly send us mad. And somebody said to me at one point, well, you have to see this computer or these computer systems like a six-year-old child who's drawn a lovely picture. You know, you want to frame it on your fridge and make it look as nice as it can, but ultimately you know that it isn't very good. And actually that did slightly change my opinion on things. You know, it couldn't be perfect because the computer was kind of wrecking quite a lot of what otherwise might have been quite fun.
Thank you for all that you've done, for the gloves and the friendship, the laughter and the gum.
When the musical came out, what did the audiences think? Could they tell that it was partly computer generated?
It was interesting. There were some people. We did a Q&A after the show one night, and a guy in the audience said, "Oh, I had no idea. I had no idea that this had been written in this manner," and that was a really interesting to hear his response. Mm. It was also very pleasing, actually, to hear the responses of the Greenham women themselves. Many of whom came to see the show knowing that there was a show about Greenham Common.
They were the women whose opinions we were most frightened of.
What did
they
say?
But actually, to a woman, they loved it. So for me, I need no higher accolade than that.
I guess I'm wondering, when you've written so many other musicals, and I imagine at the end of, you know, watching it perform for the first time, there must be this feeling of tremendous pride and ownership, knowing that all of this came out of you. Was that different, sitting in the audience watching this musical?
I think this is where it comes back to the whole thing of, you know, computer creativity is nothing without human beings. Just to interpret, really, what computers have done, you know, computers can't yet define what is good art. They don't know if they've created something that's good or not. And if you ask them to create something better, they'll just give you something different. They won't yet know how to develop something. They don't know which ways to interpret good art.
None of the systems we were using could improve upon what they had already done. They could just give us more, something else, something different.
Mm. Well, I must say I'm really reassured to hear you say that at the end of this process there is still something fundamentally deeply mysterious about art.
I think there has to be.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's really interesting. I couldn't be a composer without believing in magic. I couldn't write interesting stories without a sense of magic, without a sense of something else out there. Because, you know, at the end of the day, there are certain suspensions, there are certain chord progressions that just work. We don't understand why they work, but they make us cry, they touch us. And as long as that is the case, then I can very happily believe in magic.
Benjamin Till and Nathan Taylor are the composers of Beyond the Fence. The musical ran in London last year. For more about it, check out the documentary Computer Says Show. And special thanks to Sky Arts and Wingspan Productions for the excerpts. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We've been talking about artificial creativity in this hour, but there are still limits to what creative machines can do. For instance, as far as I know, a computer still can't have a baby. And a computer certainly can't write all the songs to an album while pregnant. But country musician Amanda Shires did both. At the time, Amanda was playing fiddle on the road for her husband, the country superstar Jason Isbell. Near the end of her pregnancy, touring got to be too much, so she stayed home, alone, for weeks, with nothing to do but write songs. And the result is her new album, My Piece of Land. Amanda Shires and her guitar player joined Charles Monroe Kane live in our studios to play and talk about how her pregnancy inspired the new album.
I was at home a lot and didn't have a lot to do, so I wrote songs.
How far along were you as you were writing them?
I got off the road at 34 weeks, I think, or so. And, you can't really fly or tour anymore. So I just went home and started putting together the crib. And then when everything that I could do, all the chores ran out, I just started writing.
There's one song I want to ask you about, the song Slippin'. Can you tell me about that song? Because to me, that song seemed almost like... it's like a pre-reprimand or something. Like, it was a very strong song for a mother and a about to be a mother and a wife to write, I thought.
The song Slippin', my husband is in recovery and he's almost 5 years clean and sober. So, and that, you know, pregnancy brings with it some, a lot of hormones and, sometimes with hormones and your changing body, you sort of, find yourself with a little more self-doubt than normal. And the idea of it came as like all ideas come to you when you're walking around during the day thinking, mm-hmm. Well, I hope he doesn't fall off the wagon today. This would be a bad time for that to happen. And then it became for me a conversation that I was having with my imaginary audience. And after I wrote this song, it was not so much a fear anymore, because like all things in the dark, you give it a name and it's not so scary anymore.
Absolutely. That's, thank you.
See, I don't know if we've done this one in a while.
We haven't.
Okay.
Trigger, then up starts the fire. A handful of matches, some faulty wiring. You'll say you have this hollow feeling, like something's always been missing. Tonight could be the night you go slipping away. Tonight could be the night you go slipping away. Tonight could be the night you go slipping away from me. Mm-hmm.
start driving south, stopping somewhere, Mississippi. You think nobody sees you, and no one is looking. And when no one is looking, no one is looking. Tonight could be the night you go slipping away. Tonight could be the night you go slipping away. Tonight could be the night you go slipping away from me. Tonight could be the night you go slipping away. Tonight could be the night you go slipping away. Tonight could be the night you go slipping away from me.
Hey, one personal clap.
There we go.
That's fantastic. So you wrote all those songs. You have these fears. Of course, it all worked out. You had a a baby.
Yeah, all the hopes, all the fears, all the joy. So
you're in Madison right now. We're in Madison, Wisconsin. You're on tour. Your husband's on tour. He's a musician as well. He's on tour. He's in Georgia today. Mm-hmm. He's performing the same time you are, but another state. Your daughter's with him. I think of that, and I'm like, how do you do that? How do you pull off the relationship with both of them in this crazy way that the road is?
We're still figuring that out, I think. But right now we try to just, you know, keep the communications open and try and encourage one another. And I can't comfortably bring her on tour with me in the 15-passenger van that I ride around in, not when Jason has the means and luxury of having a tour bus and stuff. You know, it's an easier travel day for her if she can sleep while the bus is moving and wake up and be wild and free. Whereas, you know, in the touring lifestyle that I live in is a, you know, I sit in the back in the one of the seats and sit there all day until I get to somewhere and hop out and unload stuff. So it works. It works right now for her to be in a safer place. And then as far as time apart, that's been a difficult thing, but something I think we're learning more about as we go.
I have a question about another song, if you don't mind me asking, and it sounds like an odd thing to ask. It's about the song Harmless, which really blew me away, and I guess it seems to be, if you look at it on the internet, seems to be blowing a lot of people away. Is, I read a lot into that song, and I'm not sure I'm right at all, but I read a lot into that song. And
I love it when people read their own things into it. That means you're doing something right.
Oh, good, good. Well, you're doing something right, because I was like, oh, this means this, this, and this, and this is what she's trying to tell me. I'm like, well, how could she tell me this, because she doesn't even know me. What is it about?
What is it about to you first? Well, before I ruin your ideas.
No, that's fine. For me, it's about, you know, the scenario of, like, going to the bar, flirting with somebody at the bar, and taking that line just to the edge where you're not really cheating on your spouse, but like you're flirting really hardcore and everyone's pushing that line, and it's not harmless. That's not a harmless thing to do. And we do it all the time. It's a dangerous thing to do. And that's why we do it, I think, or why I do it.
I think you're dead on. Dead on.
Oh, okay.
A phased golden light rained down from the street light. It fell across your shoulder, paused just above your collar. Like it had something to show me, as if I wasn't already noticing. Your eyes a shade of wonder, like if thunder had a color. It could have been harmless, wanting to see if I could get a little closer and walk away, breathe. It might have been cheating. Where exactly is the line? Too early to admit it.
that song blows me away. That's rare. I haven't had a feeling from a song like that in a long time. And it reminds me, like, what toll does it have on you singing something over and over again? Like, is it just whatever after a while? Or does it just keep you just keep bleeding on it all over and over again on the stage?
I think the way we approach music is that we play a song as if we're never going to get to play it again. Because we're constantly trying to remind ourselves to live in the present moment.
So you've played hundreds of thousands of songs. Every time you play one of the songs for other people, you just said you'd do it like you'll never play it again?
Yeah, I learned that from I used to be in this band called the Texas Playboys, a Western swing band, when I was about 15.
My God, I love that band. I didn't know you were in that band.
Yeah, I did Western swing for a while. I don't do Western swing anymore, but it was a big part of my life. And I learned a lot about performance and showmanship and music from those guys. And other than having, you know, clean clothes and, you know, coming to the show with all your gear working, you know, normal things, they gave me other pieces of advice like... sing this one like it's the last time you're going to sing it. And it really keeps you focused on living in the moment and not living in your performance yesterday or what you have to do tomorrow. It keeps you, you know, right there, centered.
Do you have another song for us we could kind of out with? Oh, yeah, I got loads of them.
This is called Pale Fire.
One, two, one, two, three.
Amanda Shire's new album is called My Piece of Land. She talked with Charles Monroe Kane.
She took her lover on a road trip.
That's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. That way you'll never miss a show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tongakar produced this hour with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mark Rickers. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.
Here's a pale fire.
PRI, Public Radio International.